we're doing Parashat Ki Teitze, and we're basically holding it shortly after Shavi, towards the end of the parasha. The parasha tells us we don't give special treatment to an orphan or to a person who's a ger, a convert, even though we have to give them preferential treatment in most matters. We have to treat them extra kindly. But when it comes to the justice system, their justice has to be served, and we don't take into account the fact that a person is an orphan. If he owes money, we're going to say he has to pay the money. If he doesn't, he won't. But we don't give him preferential treatment when it comes to the justice system. We have a special mitzvah of shikicha, that when one is harvesting and one forgets a bundle in the field, to leave it for the poor. So Hashem says, I will bless you. You perform this mitzvah and I will bless you. And the same thing is true when we're harvesting our olive grove or our vineyard, that we leave behind the things that drop, we leave behind the things that we forget, we leave them for the poor. Do you mind moving to the right or left so the video camera fits in? Sorry. Whichever way you prefer. Now, we're holding Parashat Ki Teitze, the book of Devarim, and we're up to the 25th chapter. Yes. Shikecha, Shin Kaf Ches He. Sefer Devarim, Perek Chaf He, the first pasuk. The Torah tells us that there will be instances when the courts have to give lashes. And when the courts give lashes, they are told to give lashes up to 40 lashes, which means 39, and they're not allowed to hit beyond that. And directly following that, the Torah says, Pasuk Dalet, lo tachsom sho bidisho, do not muzzle an ox as it is threshing the wheat. So we derive from the juxtaposition of these two commandments that when does the court give lashes? When one transgresses a prohibition that is similar to the prohibition of lo tachsom sho bidisho, do not muzzle an ox when it is threshing the wheat.
What is muzzling?
Put the three words on.
And we discussed last night that the animals, you can put its own basket under its mouth where an animal will eat something else while it's threshing. Now, what do we derive from this? We say, just like lo tachsom sho bidisho, Torah says don't put a muzzle, that's an active prohibition. You have to do something in order to transgress. So too, the only time a person will get lashes is if he transgresses an active prohibition. Cannot be a prohibition that he transgresses by just sitting idly by. It has to be a prohibition that one cannot make up by paying money. So we say a prohibition that's made up by money, we do not get lashes. It has to be a prohibition that is not connected to a proactive commandment, an asay, lavanitak laasay. If it is connected to an asay, then you don't get lashes. So those are some of the details. It has to be a lav sheyesh bo maisa, we mentioned earlier. So some of the details, the Gemara in Makos discusses at length what are all the details, but in general we derive from the juxtaposition of this, that the Torah tells us the courts can give lashes, and then the Torah tells us this prohibition that one, the courts only give lashes for a transgression that is similar to the transgression of not muzzling the ox, and the details of that you'll learn b'zachem in Makot. It has to be a negative commandment, lav sheyesh bo maise. It has to be a lav that one transgresses by doing an action. Then the Torah tells us, what happens if two brothers are living together, meaning they're both in the world at the same time, not a situation where one dies and then the next one's born. They have to both be alive at the same time, and then one of them dies. So there's a special mitzvah that he dies without children. So there's a special mitzvah that the brother-in-law will perform yibum, that he will marry her. And if he says, I do not want to marry her, so then she goes to the elders and she declares he doesn't want to marry me. And he gets called by the elders and he declares, I don't want to marry her. And then the yevama, the sister-in-law, removes his shoe from his foot, spits before him and says, this is what should be done before a person who does not want to rebuild his brother's house. And everyone declares his house is the house that the shoe was removed. And then she's free to marry anyone she wants. And this procession is called chalitza. And I want us to take a few minutes to discuss halachically how chalitza is performed. This is a mitzvah that most people know nothing about. And really, it's a mitzvah that's still relevant today. Unfortunately, today, a couple that can have fertility issues, or if God forbid, the husband dies shortly after they get married, it can happen that a husband will die, leaving his wife without children. And then our custom is that we do not perform yibum. The brothers do not marry her. The only thing we do is chalitza. So this is a biblical commandment which we still perform today. And we should know a little bit about how it works. So in Shulchan Aruch, in the end of Eben Ezer, we have laws of chalitza. We have a whole tractate of Yevamos. And we will quickly summarize the laws of chalitza, just so we get a picture of it. This is the one instance where the action must be performed before a court. We know that marriage does not require a court. Divorce also does not require a court. We divorce the man, the rabbi officiates, he writes, we have the scribe, we have the two witnesses. But in order for a person to do this action, biblically there must be a court present. So ordinarily we don't convene a court that is biblical. Almost everything that we do, our courts are rabbinic. When it comes to convening a court for chalitza, this is one time where the courts are biblically acting. So really the courts don't have to be the greatest rabbis in the world for this action of chalitza. There just must be a court of noble people present. It is customary that we take the rabbi of the city and the two important people of the city and we appoint them as the court for chalitza. Really, technically, all we need are three judges, but we prefer to have five, so they invite two more people to join them. We have to establish a place where the chalitza will be performed. So the judges declare a day beforehand, tomorrow we're performing chalitza in this place. And they send an invitation to the Yavam, to the brother-in-law, and to the Yavama, to the sister-in-law, to come to that place the next day. She's going to have to spit before him, and we want her to spit because she wants to spit, not because she has too much phlegm. So the custom is that she fasts from the morning till the time that she'll do chalitza, so there won't be any room to say, she just spit to clear her throat, she just spit because she ate something distasteful. The custom is that she fasts from the morning. We know that in order for someone to be kosher as a witness or as a judge, they cannot be a sinful person. A person who has a sin that he does regularly cannot be a judge and cannot be a witness. So this is relevant if any of you get invited to be a witness at a wedding ceremony. Sometimes friends ask their friends to be a witness. If a person knows that he doesn't live up to certain commandments, he should refuse the invitation. If a person knows he's lenient in this issue of Shabbos, or he shaves with a razor, so these are prohibitions, a person should say, look, take someone else. He doesn't have to explain why, but he should not agree, because he's really doing his friend a disservice. If a person knows that he tries to perform all 613 mitzvot, so even then, before starting his position as witness, a person should stop and think to himself, I want to do tshuva for everything I ever did wrong. Because if we accept upon ourselves to do tshuva, the mere fact that we've accepted it makes it that we are now on our way to doing tshuva. And even if a person, let's say his whole life, he was lenient with something that he shouldn't have been, he was sinful in an area that's wrong of him, the second he starts doing tshuva, so there's room to qualify him as a witness. So lechatchila, we don't do that. But just in case, when we have a kosher witness, so then we also ask him, quietly whisper, think about doing tshuva. We don't want to embarrass him. We don't want to tell him, hey buddy, you better do tshuva. So we quietly whisper it in. The same thing is true here with the mitzvah of chalitza. When we're going to have this court of rabbis, so the rabbis are, this is an instance where in order for the chalitza to be qualified, they have to be qualified judges. That means that, let's say one of them did something that was wrong, and he doesn't remember it, but he regularly does it. So let's take a simple example. He bites his nails on Shabbos. Not supposed to bite your nails on Shabbos. Before beginning to reign over this case, the judges do the same thing that witnesses do. At a wedding ceremony, they have to think to themselves, I want to do tshuva for anything I ever did wrong. This is to ensure that they are qualified as judges. the day before the chalitza, the custom is that they go to the place where they're going to perform the chalitza, and they stay there a little bit, so to speak. They prepare the place that that's where the court is going to convene and perform the chalitza. We try to do the chalitza in a place that's famous. The idea is that everyone should know about it. Sometimes we choose the highest place in the city. The custom is that they do it right after shul, so that people are still around the shul, and then they'll do it. Shuls are supposed to be in the highest place of town, so then people will be around and it's supposed to be famous. We want to have a minimum of 10 people present when we do it. The court sends messengers to the Yavama, and they ask her not to eat that day. And they tell her, don't spit before we tell you it's time to spit. We don't do chalitza at night or on Shabbos or on Yom Tov or on the eve of a Shabbos, on Fridays or on Erev Yom Tov. And on the day of the chalitza, they come to the pre-assigned place, and the judges sit. The chief judge sits in the middle, and the two judges sit on his side. And the Yavam and Yavama, they stand. And the Yavam and Yavama come to the court, and we bring more people, as we mentioned, so it should be famous. And everyone has to sit at a distance so that everyone can see what's going on. The Yavama and the Yavam, they have to be adults. Neither one could be a minor. And then we have two witnesses that their job is to tell us who these people are. So we ask him, do you know her that she's not a minor? Do you know her that she was married to the brother? Do you know her that 92 days have passed since her husband died? We want to ensure that she's not pregnant. So we give it 3 months, 92 days. Do you know that Yavam, the brother-in-law, he's not a minor? We need to know if he's a ger, that was he, how's he his brother? Because gerim don't ordinarily have brothers. Was the mother pregnant when she became a ger? How does that work? Do you know for a fact that there were no living children left behind? So we question these two witnesses. And they're supposed to be people who really know the family. After we question these witnesses, so we verify, are you a righty? We ask the woman. And we ask the Yavam, when you walk, are you a righty or a lefty? This is the one place where we want to use the right foot. And if he's a lefty, so then there are different opinions as to whether we use his right foot, his left foot, or we don't do either one. So we question them, and then we tell them, okay, stand. And they both stand, and we ask her, do you want this? She says, yeah. We ask him, do you want this? He says, yeah. And then he declares he doesn't want to marry her, and then we start the procession. They have to know that once she removes the shoe, technically she is permitted to marry anyone else. Both have to have in mind that in this action, she will be permitted to marry someone else. And he has to be in a situation where he's not being forced to do it. So sometimes we'll trick him, if we have to. There were instances in the Gemara where he only wanted to marry her for her money. So the rabbis figured out ways of tricking him to do the chalitza. But he has to do it of a good mind. He has to be willing to do it. And just like before a get, we ask him to declare that if he ever declared in advance that anything that would nullify this procession, he is annulling anything he declared in advance. Because a person could stand beforehand and tell two witnesses, I'm just doing a fake. When I'm doing it, you guys are witnesses that I don't have a mind to permit her to the marketplace. So a person could do that when it comes to chalitza. So we make him declare before the chalitza that any declaration he made beforehand is hereby nullified. We do the same thing with a get. We give the shoe, the chief justice gives the shoe to the guy, to the brother-in-law, and he puts it on his right hand. And this is a sandal that's made specifically of hide, and it has to be his size, and it has two straps. Everything's made of hide, and he ties it on his foot. And then he's not allowed to wear socks. It has to be directly on his foot. And then after binding the shoe on his foot, the sandal on his foot with the two straps, he leans slightly on a wall and he digs his foot into the ground. And then she has to come with her right hand. She could hold on to his foot with the left hand and pull off the shoe with her right hand. And when she does that, technically at that moment she becomes permitted to marry anyone else. This is the procession that the Torah says. What's the logic behind it? So the Sefer HaChinuch explains that what she's saying is, I was supposed to be your wife. I would have been willing to do anything for you, even take off your shoe, even a menial job that usually a servant does, takes off the master's shoe. I would have done anything for you because we were supposed to be husband and wife. Ever since I married your brother, now that your brother died, we're supposed to be husband and wife. And you refused that. So now I'm taking off your shoe and I'm spitting on the ground before you. From this minute, you're like a stranger. It doesn't mean literally in his face. She spits to the ground before him. And we read the parsha. The courts tell her to read the verses that say, he doesn't want to marry me. And he reads the verses that say, I don't want to marry her. And then after we read, each one reads their part of the procession. So she does the spitting. And then each one understands what they're saying. And then she becomes free to go to the market to marry anyone else. Everyone who's standing there declares his house is the house of the one whose shoe was removed, Bet Chalutzanat. The Torah, we're just out of time, so we got to continue quickly. The Torah tells us if two people are fighting, and one's wife wants to save her husband, so she reaches out and grabs the other guy's private parts. So in Chazal's time, they considered this that she's endangering his life. The two were fighting, but they weren't trying to kill one another. And she wants to save her husband, so she grabs the other guy by his private parts and she starts pulling. So the Gemara says that she's really endangering his life, and the Gemara says, cut off her hand. Save the guy any way you could. If you need to cut off her hand, cut off her hand. If you need to kill her, kill her. And from here we derive the concept of rodef, that if one is endangering someone else's life, then we have to save that other person, even if it means we have to kill the guy. If you could save him without killing the guy who's giving chase, so you don't kill. There's a story in the Gemara about a guy who did kill, and the courts held him accountable for it. By what right did you kill the guy? One guy was chasing Asael, was chasing after Avner to kill him, and Avner told him, leave me alone, I'm warning you, leave me alone, and Asael wouldn't leave him alone. So Avner stuck his knife back and hit him in the fifth rib, a place where he knew he'd detach his liver and kill him on the spot. And that's what he did, he killed him on the spot. And Yoav, Asael's brother, took Avner to court and said, what'd you kill him for? So Avner said, what do you mean? He was chasing after me, he wanted to kill me. So Yoav said, what do you mean? You could have cut his feet off, what'd you have to kill him for? So Avner said, I couldn't aim properly. So Yoav said, that's baloney. If you could aim and kill him with one shot, you aimed so well that you were able to detach his liver, you hit him right at the spot where he dropped dead on the spot, you could have also aimed and maimed him. And that's what you should have done. And because of that, Avner was executed. So this concept of rodef is derived from here. This woman is considered a rodef. And we apply it also to situations of complications in pregnancy. Sometimes there could be a complication where the child endangers the mother. So we will say that fetus is really a rodef. He's chasing after the mother to kill her. He's endangering her life, and her life comes first. The Torah then prohibits us from having unjust weights. The Torah says, don't even have them in your house. You'll say, I'm not using it. The mere fact that you have it in your house is a transgression. And then the Torah gives us the commandment to remember what Amalek did to us, that they saw that we were God-fearing people and God was on our side. And they stood up and they showed the world, you could attack Israel, even though we beat the daylights out of them. The mere fact that someone stood up to us and took us to war already made it that the world could fight us. People said, you see, you could fight them. And here, the idea behind this commandment that we're supposed to remember them and wipe them out is that God is telling the Jewish people, when someone starts with you, he's starting with me. Anyone that hates you, hates me. And if they hate me, then I hate them. And just like Amalek, who tried to wipe out the Jewish people, God says, you have a mitzvah to wipe them out. This mitzvah teaches us that by the same token, anyone who tries to harm the Jewish people, God will take them to task. As badly as they try to harm us, corresponding to that, God will ultimately take them to task. Shabbat Shalom.